The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how good dogs live longer. Their disposition has an effect, Dave?
It turns out it does, Rob. This story is all about what factors make certain species live longer than others. You know, why does an elephant live for years and mice only live for months? And it's a hard thing to test because a lot of this may have happened via natural selection. You know, there may have been certain traits that were selected for that maybe conferred a certain advantage to an animal, maybe making it more aggressive, but being more aggressive made it a better hunter and maybe was able to procure food better, but also maybe that same trait also shortened its lifespan because it was so aggressive, maybe that its heart beat really fast and that really increased its metabolism and caused it to run out its lifespan a lot faster than maybe another animal would.
So natural selection versus people selection.
Well, right. This is a hard theory to test because we can't just take a bunch of animals and naturally select them ourselves over millions of years and figure out what happens. But dogs have been a nice natural experiment because we have been, as you say, self-selecting these animals for over 10,000 years for specific traits, like, you know, some dogs have been bred to be good hunting dogs and some dogs have just been bred for looking nice on a couch. And so what a researcher did in this study was to look at various breeds of dogs and see if there was any correlation between personality and lifespan. And that's actually what he found. He found that obedient dogs like German Shepherds and Bichon Frises actually live very long for their size, whereas hard-to-train dogs like Beagles and Pomeranians generally died earlier than similarly sized breeds. And what's more, the researcher also found that peaceful dogs like Newfoundlands, which are these really large dogs, and Labradors tend to burn less energy per kilogram than really aggressive dogs do, like Fox Terriers and Great Danes. And so what the researcher thinks is, you know, this is all correlation, but what he saw is that these dogs with these sort of more peaceful, more obedient personalities tended to be the types of dogs that lived longer for their size range than dogs on the opposite end of the spectrum.
Are researchers willing to extend this hypothesis or extend this correlation to other species like us?
Well, it's a good question, Rob. There's nothing in this study to indicate that this has any application to humans, whether more peaceful or I don't know how you would define an obedient human, but definitely more easygoing humans might live longer. Although we do know that stress can be an important factor for shortening lifespan. So it's possible that there are some implications for humans as well.
Okay, so what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from personality in dogs to intelligence in birds, and specifically crows. This next story is all about a type of crow known as the New Caledonian crow, which is actually known as a feathered ape because it has been demonstrated to be very smart in a lot of previous experiments.
What kind of smartness are we talking about here?
Well, believe it or not, there have been some studies that have shown that these crows can actually understand some rudimentary physics and that they can actually recognize themselves and other humans. We actually, a while ago in a podcast...
Oh, right. I remember they were attacking people who were wearing Dick Cheney masks.
Exactly. And so we know these crows are smart. The question is, how smart are they? And one classic experiment that's been done with these crows is to show that they can use tools. Researchers give them a stick and they use the stick to maybe probe down a hole and get a worm out of it. And actually, that is not so unique to crows. In fact, other animals, even ants, can use tools. But what was interesting with crows is that researchers showed that if they gave crows a really small stick, say a stick that couldn't get all the way down a hole to get a worm, the crows could use that small stick to get a larger stick, and then they would use that larger stick to get the worm. And researchers had claimed from this study, which was conducted a couple years ago, that not only does this show that crows are smart because they know how to use tools, but that they actually are capable of this higher cognition, of this ability to sort of plan ahead. They're not just saying, hey, I need a tool to get that worm. They're saying, hey, I need this tool to get that tool, and that tool is going to help me get a worm. This really complex flow of logic, researchers say, you know, we've really only seen that in primates.
But other scientists called that into doubt?
Exactly. A lot of other scientists had said, some skeptics of the study had said, you guys are really sort of overinterpreting this result. And what their criticism was is that when the crows were given this smaller stick, they weren't really thinking ahead that, hey, the smaller stick is going to help me get the larger stick, which is going to help me get the worm. They just associated this smaller stick with the eventual food reward. So they saw the small stick as something good that helped them get the larger stick and that helped them get the worm.
So they saw the small stick as a good thing, the larger stick as a good thing. Whatever the case, just go get the good thing.
Exactly. As the skeptic said, this is all just an association. You know, one good thing gets me another good thing. And, you know, there is some intelligence there. It doesn't really represent a complex sort of planning or being able to follow this flow of logic that researchers have associated with humans and other primates.
So what about this new study?
Well, this new study is all about an attempt to get around that problem. What researchers did was they said, let's get crows to really hate this small stick. You know, if these skeptics are saying that these crows are just using the small stick because they like it or they associate it with food, let's get them to really dislike it, to view it as what they call an unattractive object, and see if they can still use it in the same way. So what they did is they took a few crows and they gave them the small stick, and they also presented the crows with something to use the stick on. They would, you know, put a treat in a hole or behind a cage, and the crows could never get this treat because the stick was too small. So they would try to use the stick and they would give up after a few attempts. And in fact, they would actually have behaviors that indicated they really disliked this stick. After a few attempts, they would sort of throw the stick away or toss it down. They really came to dislike the stick exactly as researchers hoped they would. And then what researchers did was they repeated this classic experiment where they gave these crows again the small stick, but this time the crows could use the small stick to get a larger stick to get the reward. But they made things even more unattractive for the small stick. So already they knew the crows didn't like this small stick anymore. But now they tied this small stick to a rope on a branch. So not only did the crows have to get the stick that they didn't really like, they really had to go through a lot of machinations to get this stick. And what the researchers found was that even though the crows didn't like the small stick and the small stick was really hard to get, when the crows realized that they could use the small stick to get a larger stick to get their reward, they used it. And there's actually a really cool video in the story, which I highly encourage everybody to take a look at. This is a video of a female crow. And what's really special about her is a lot of these other crows I just talked about, they had to make a few attempts with the small stick and the larger stick before they really got the hang of knowing, okay, the small stick is going to get me the larger stick, which is going to get me the reward. But you'll see in this video, there's a female crow that basically looked at the whole setup. She saw the small stick hanging from the tree. She saw the large stick on a table, and she saw the food reward hidden behind something that she could only get with a large stick. And without any trial and error, after sort of staring at the setup for a couple minutes, she goes ahead. She goes straight to that small stick, grabs it, goes to the big stick, grabs that, and uses the big stick to get the reward. So she worked out this whole thing in her mind, didn't have to fail at all, and got everything on the first try. You can see all this happening in the video.
So does this convince researchers that that's what's going on inside the crow's brain?
Well, you know, it's hard to say whether this is going to convince all the skeptics. At least one outside expert thought this was a very powerful experiment. The researchers do say, though, that it does really address this criticism of the previous study that, you know, the crows were just using these small sticks because they were making these positive associations with them. And it really does get us further along the lines of being able to claim that maybe animals that we don't think are as intelligent as humans or other primates, like birds, actually might be capable of this very advanced cognition.
Okay. So last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, I feel like we're working our way down the food chain here a little bit. But this last story is about fish and specifically mercury levels in tuna. And this study is claiming that the tuna that you get in sushi at restaurants actually has a lot more mercury in it than the tuna-filled sushi that you would get at a supermarket.
Why the difference?
Well, the difference has to do with the type of tuna that's actually used in these different types of sushi. And nobody had really done a comprehensive study of it before. You know, researchers knew that, you know, there's a few tuna species that tend to end up in sushi. And why tuna itself tends to accumulate so much mercury in the first place is that the species at the top of the food chain in the ocean, the higher up you are in the food chain, the more animals you've eaten who themselves have eaten more animals. And if you've got mercury starting at the lowest levels, this really builds up a lot. And especially if you're talking about something like a bluefin tuna, which can weigh more than 500 kilograms, you're talking about potentially a lot of mercury accumulating in these fish.
So the restaurants serve tuna from these larger fish than the ones in the supermarket.
Exactly. And they tend to serve sushi that has tuna from species that accumulate more of this mercury. And in fact, what the researchers did here, which really hadn't been done before, is they employed something called DNA barcoding. And they essentially took samples of tuna. They took 100 sushi samples from 54 restaurants and 15 supermarkets. And what DNA barcoding does is it basically... it allows you to look for specific genetic markers that would distinguish one species from the next. And what they found was they found that, you know, when you combine restaurant tuna and supermarket tuna, you're talking about five species. And what the team found was that restaurant sushi tends to contain big eye tuna or lean bluefin tuna. And these types of tuna had concentrations of mercury that were actually 4% above what the FDA recommended limit is for mercury. And the reason we care about mercury is it's been shown to cause severe neurological problems in humans, especially can be a real problem for pregnant women and young children. And researchers found that the type of tuna that's usually found in supermarkets is yellowfin tuna, which tends to be cheaper and it's a more plentiful species, but it contains less mercury than restaurant tuna, but it still exceeds the FDA limits for mercury. So even with the supermarket tuna, you're getting more mercury than you should be getting. You're just not getting as much as you're getting typically when you eat out at a restaurant.
So what do researchers hope will come of this study?
Well, from the consumer angle, the researchers are saying, you know, if you eat a lot of sushi, make sure it's not a lot of tuna sushi, you know, eat this tuna sushi in moderation because of the elevated mercury levels. And for the purveyors of the sushi, he's saying that they really should be more proactive about putting labels on the sushi they're selling so consumers know what sort of tuna is being used and they can cross-reference that with what types of tuna tend to have more mercury in them.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about how taking a nap may help you learn better. And continuing the neuroscience angle, a story about these brain training games. Maybe you've seen them on mobile devices. Do they actually work? Do they actually help improve cognition? And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about the Iceland volcano and how it's impacting science. Specifically, it's having a very large impact, negative impact on scientific meetings and what exactly that impact is. And also a story about the invasive lionfish, which is decimating fish in the Caribbean. The National Science Foundation has just announced a big grant to study and potentially help stop these fish. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories from the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.